Now describe these molds. How were they built?
Well, the molds were built of quite heavy material and were covered on top with iron for protection. And they weighed 15, 20 pounds apiece, and the brick probably weighed 40 pounds. So he had to lift 3,500 or more a day. So you can see how many tons that he lifted.
Well, how much did the mold and the six brick weigh times 3,500?
Well, 50 pounds or more, we'll say, times 3,500, so you can figure out that he lifted several tons in a day.
Now, let me ask you this. After they were dumped onto the pallet, continue that operation. Where did the pallet go?
Well,
where was the pallet?
There was the easy job, which was my job for a half a day when I was 12 years old, was to turn the turntable and put another pallet on it so he could continue dumping. And on the opposite side, the truckers were there waiting to lift them off and take them to the drying sheds.
Any pallets sat on this could be accommodated by this turntable? You said it was a six-sided turntable, is that correct?
Yes.
And then as it revolved around to the, did you say the truckers?
The truckers.
And what did they do with the pallets with the fresh, undried brick?
Well, they trucked them to the drying sheds, and they had a truck that was made especially for that purpose. It was long and held about 10 pallets. Or in other words, that'd be 10 times 60, about 60 brick. And they wheeled them and put them in the drying sheds.
Now, I want to ask you this. How did this operation function? What were these drying sheds? What were they made out of? Describe them so that the class will know.
Well, they were quite long, and they were probably 6 feet between them, and then the racks that you placed the pallets on were 10 high. They were built upright with cross pieces so you could put pallets on either side of them, and that would balance them on the two before that was down the center of them.
Well, to help delineate this, these racks were vertical and about how high?
Why, the top one was probably 5.5 foot.
And then on top of the racks, there was a roof on each one?
Yes, a peaked roof over each one that covered them, and then the doors were tipped back on the peak so that in case of rain they could be closed and keep the weather away from the brick.
Now let me get this picture clear, so that these racks were something like aisles in a supermarket that would receive the pallets on each side with the stanchion in the middle, the support
right.
In the middle.
That's right.
And the racks or the arms holding the pallets would only have to be about 10 inches out from the post or the support, is that correct?
Yeah, 10 inches on either side and probably 4 inches in the center. They were probably about 24 inches long. They were made out of 1x1 oak, and the 2x4 between them that held them was grooves, so it helped to hold them in place.
And then the first, at the bottom, how far off the ground was the first shelf or rack?
As I remember, about 10 inches.
And then they were spaced equally, is that right?
Yes, just so you could slide a pallet in there and probably 6 inches between them.
And how many pallets high, sir?
10 is.
10. And that was the same number of pallets that was on one of these trucks?
That's right.
Now they wheeled these trucks in between the racks, and so you said there were doors to close, roof doors. How much space was there between the rows of racks?
About 5 or 6 feet, just enough so a man could wheel down the center and unload on either side.
In other words,
by the way, all these we used steel wheelbarrows in those days and used plank to run on, so these plank were the full length of the sheds.
In other words, there was two rows of planks in every aisleway.
No, one row, because we used one wheelbarrow.
One wheelbarrow. All right, now let me ask you this. What did the truckers do after they emptied their after they placed their pallets on the racks?
Well, they returned to the turntable where they picked up another load. They used two sheds. two sheds, two of them worked on either side of the rack, so they'd be out of each other's way.
How many truckers were there to accommodate this six-sided turntable without any loss of time or downtime?
Four truckers.
Four truckers, and could they, if they worked steady, they could keep the machine going, the machine could keep them going, is that correct?
That's right. And, once in a while, when they'd get on the engineers, he'd speed it up and try to get them to work a little faster to aggravate them or something like that. That caused trouble occasionally.
Now, you mentioned about the danger of this receiving bin where the clay cars dump the clay into the gears. Was there any other point of operation on that combined pug mill and press or molding machine that was a dangerous spot?
Yes, the sander or the man putting the mold in the machine had to be very careful. The mold had handles on either end, and if he used that, he was all right, but once in a while they would just push him in from the corner or something like that. In fact, one man, Carl Sperry, who's still alive and lives on Dutch Road, lost a finger that way. And I think that was about 1916. I still remember it.
Now, on this operation, how long did it take for the brick to dry?
Well, it depends a lot on the weather, but normally it was about a week time it was completed. It would take 2 days, usually, before they would edge these bricks.
What do you mean by edging, Wyman?
Well, they were made to lay, when they were made, they were laid flatways on the pallet, and they had to be turned up on the narrow edge in order to properly dry.
In other words, for all four sides to dry, they had to
right.
be edged up on...
And we call that edging. And that was the first job any of us boys had, was to edge them. We got, as I remember, $1.50 for turning 22,000 brick.
Now, did they have to all be turned the same way, or was there any...
Yes, they were all turned the same way, of course, so that when they were handled, they would be improper.
Now, how many brick a day did this operation turn out?
22,000 was a day's work, whether it took them 6 hours or 8 hours, or in case of rain or something, they might have to work till 6 o'clock at night.
Now, if 22,000 brick a day were made, how many sheds were required to effect a proper drying if you made 22,000 a day? How many days capacity could you put in the drying sheds?
Well, it took about six sheds for 22,000, and we had about enough for 6 days, so if the thing worked out, if everybody got his job done, we could keep right on going. Probably 2 acres of sheds.
And these were all constructed and built right next to the molding machines and turntables, so to cut down on the distance that these green brick had to be wheeled or trucked.
That's right. When they got to the far corners, the truckers had to hurry right along because it was a lot rougher.
All right, now let me ask you this. The sheds, one tier of sheds, how many days run, how many sheds did it take for 1 day's run?
Six sheds.
Now, what would the effect of weather have upon the drying process?
Well, of course, if it rained all day, they couldn't make brick, and that set them back a day, but the others didn't dry, so it kind of worked out about the same, but it took a couple days of good weather for to edge them, and then a couple days after that. So we figured about it once a week they filled the yards and everything.
Now, did these particular brick have any holes or grooves or serrations in them?
No, these were solid brick.
Why were they solid brick in those days?
Well, a lot of people used brick in different positions. In other words, most brick are laid on their flat side, but some of them would there's a house on South River Road that's laid on the narrow edge. That was not the common way, but a lot of them used them. They didn't want any holes in them or anything, so they could do that.
Now, after the brick got into the drying sheds, and you said there was about 2 acres of drying sheds to accommodate the drying process in order to have a quantity for the next step in the operation. What happened next?
Well, the next job was, after they were dried, they had to be wheeled into the kills, or made into kills, whichever way you want to say.
Now, these kills, which we talk of in the industry as kills, actually that word was spelt K-I-L-N, isn't that correct?
Yes. Actually, some of the factories had round kills that were made, and they put them inside of the kills, but ours were built outside, and each kill was individual, entirely new.
In other words, our kills were known as Scove kills, and they were self-contained and built up, whereas some of the more sophisticated kills and expensive to build were what we called the circular downdraft kills. Is that correct?
That's right.
I'd like to have you describe those kills, because I know you know more about them than I do, Wyman.
Well, they were made in arches, Bob. As I recall, 22,000 brick a day's work was one kill.
Now,
or one arch.
Right? One arch. Now, let me ask you this. How wide did the kill end up that the arch went all the way through at the ground?
Well, at least 30 feet wide.
And how high? And
probably 12 feet high. And the arch was at the bottom 2 feet wide and probably 3 feet high. Of course, it was arched, as the word says, and closed on top of that. The brick would pile solid above the arch.
In other words, a 22,000 brick run would consist of one arch. Now, in a kill, how many arches made up a burning kill?
Well, about 15.
And how many brick would that be for the people to understand the value and the jeopardy on these kills if they weren't handled carefully?
Well, of course, 22,000, 15 arches would be about 330,000, I guess, if I'm figuring right.
330,000 for one burning kill, is that correct?
That's right.
And what was the capacity of our yard? How many kills could we have continuously built up in that manner?
Well, we usually could build at least 3 and sometimes 4. Now, once in a while in the spring when we were short of brick, and the weather wasn't right, they might close the kill off at 10 or 12 arches in order to get some bricks
ready for market.
Some customers were waiting for them.
And Wyman, how were the brick positioned and placed in these kills above the arches in order to get the optimum baking and less loss?
Well, these bricks, of course, were I guess we'd call the word haken. The man that piled these brick had to be quite an expert at it. They were alternated. Each row was on just a little different angle so that the heat would penetrate up through them, so the draft could get up there.
Would it be possible that at one time the family owners would have nearly 1 million brick in one kill?
No, not in one kill, but they'd have 1 million brick or more on hand, probably in 3 kills.
All right, now let me ask you this. After the brick were piled up or haked, as the case may be, what was the next step in preparation of getting the kill ready for the burning process?
Well, these kills were lined with used brick or brick, three-quarter brick or whatever was on hand.
You mean lying on the outside or the inside?
On the outside. They're solid inside. There's no way of getting in there. It was around the outside and across the top to keep the weather away from them and to keep the heat in. After they were lined, they were plastered with mud.
How thick was that plaster coat of mud?
Well, it was just as thick as you could get it on there. I suppose an inch or inch and a half at the most. Now, on the end of these kills, they made pits about 2 feet to 3 feet wide and fill them with...
Well, how long were they? If they're 2 to 3 foot wide and the entire width?
Approximately would probably be a foot or two in from each side, so they're probably 25 feet long.
Depending on the width of that particular kiln?
Well, the kilns were all the same width on account of the building and so on. They were all approximately the same.
But well, now you mentioned on the... they were all the same width. To help record this history, this brick making, the brick kilns were built up under enclosures known as brick sheds also, or kill sheds.
Kill shed, that's right. And then, of course, the rough boards were removable, and when they got hot, they had to take those boards off. But they had to have the boards on in the beginning so the rain wouldn't ruin the brick before they were burned. Now,
so just like the drying sheds had safety measures from rain and weather to close them up, the kill sheds could be closed up until the burning process started.
That's right. Then these pits on the end were filled with sand and dried to use in the sanding machine that we mentioned earlier.
And isn't it true that they had a sand storage house at the end of the kill shed, which would reduce the amount of moving of the dried sand also?
That's right.
Now let me ask you this before we get on any further. How many men, how big a crew did it take to move these brick when they were dried green brick from the drying sheds to the kiln, including the building of the kiln?
Well, there were three men that trucked them all, or wheeled them. We call those men wheelers, and they wheeled the 22,000 brick into the kiln, and then the one man, the haker, piled them. Of course, when they were at the bottom, the wheelers could pile them right onto the kiln. But
and as the brick piled higher, he moved up.
He had to toss those brick up to the man up, the haker up on top, and that was hard work. They usually tossed about six at a time, and he had to catch them the same without any of them spilling.
In other words, the wheelers used leather gloves, and they took six brick on ends and actually threw them up, and the haker caught six at a time.
That's right. Of course, actually, he stood probably 6 feet above them and then piled them.
Now, did this require a certain amount of expertise to build these kilns so that there wouldn't be the loss in the some being half-baked and some fully baked?
It sure did, and of course, the haker was very proud of his job, and he tried to do the very best job he could. And the one we had, as I remember, I think his name was J. Page. He was an expert at it and was proud of his work.
Did he get extra pay for this knowledge?
Well, these four were among the higher paid men, along with the dumper and another man or two around there. The crane operator, I guess, was another man.
Wyman, let me ask you this. Of the most important part of all the process of making brick, was that the actual burning or baking?
That's right. That's just like making a cake. You can make it all every way you want it, but it has to be burned just right or baked just right. And that was a 24-hour job. It took two men when they burned with wood and coal, night and day. Each one worked 12 hours.
Now let me ask you this. You mentioned wood and coal. Thinking of the market area, the raw materials and so on, in the early days, where was the source of the cord of the wood that was used to burn these kilns?
Well, that was a wintertime job, and Dad had several pieces of wood that he would lumber off. They would cut the logs and sell them, and then they would cut the smaller trees and the tops of the larger ones into cordwood. And he usually gave so much a cord for cutting.
Well, let me ask you this, for a local interest again. Where the Shiawassee Game Preserve now, isn't that the area where we had a couple 40-acre plots and an 80-acre plot down there? And the key men we would keep over the winter time so they wouldn't be seasonal employees, and those key men could provide enough wood to run for the entire season. Is that correct?
Yes. I can remember when they cut wood on the Fitzhugh property, which is on the end of Swan Creek Road.
Now, wait a minute. That Fitzhugh is an old name here at the end of Swan Creek. Is that down by the Merrill Bridge?
Yes, just south of the Merrill Bridge and off into the left as you're going south.
Would that be towards what is known as Green Point Island down there at the confluence of the Tittabawassee and the Saginaw and Shiawassee rivers?
Yeah, it was near an old coal mine down in there. I remember that. Riverside coal mine, I believe it was. And then they cut lots of it up back of the Bliss mine.
Now the Bliss mine, to help us out here, is that up there where the large Hart farm is at the corner of South Miller and Swan Creek Road?
Yes, that's they have a section and a half there, and this was on the south end of that property. It was where it's all government reservation now or wildlife.
Well, let me ask you this. What function did the coal have in this process when cordwood was the basic material? You mentioned wood and coal. Tell us about the coal.
Well, they started them with wood and burned them for 3-4 days with wood, but they couldn't get it hot enough, so they had to change. They had grills, you might say, or grates that they put in there after 3-4 days, and then started firing with coal in order to get it hot enough.
Now, did they have to stoke this coal from each side of the kiln or just one side?
No, each side. So that meant there was 30. There were 30 fires to build, you might say.
And in other words, the burners had to push this coal in and keep the temperature even. Is that correct?
That's right. And that was a full-time job in the summertime when it was hot.
Do you recall, prior to the use of the jet oil system, what temperature we burned these kilns at?
I think it was 2200 degrees. I wouldn't say for sure.
And how many days did it take to get the brick so they were marketable from the time the fires were started?
About 6 or 7 days.
And you state that this took two shifts of men who worked 12 hours each. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right.
Now, how did they get the coal to the kilns?
Well, these kilns were on the opposite end, as we mentioned, of the drying sheds, and they were just adjacent to the railroad track, which was probably 20 feet. And they shipped this coal in from local mines, Southern Coal, Kentucky, and so on, and unloaded it along the railroad tracks.
Well, let me ask you this. One of the interesting features of this coal, when we had to buy Kentucky coal, it cost more for the freight from Kentucky than the coal itself, but it gave a better even temperature. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. The freight was higher than the coal.
And then, of course, it required additional men to get the coal off the gondola cars to the area where it'd be convenient for the men, the burners, to burn. Is that correct?
That's right. It took a certain amount of men to either haul the wood up where they could get it or to haul the coal. We always had 3-4 extra men because the debris and the waste from these kilns had to be hauled away after the brick were sold. So there was about 3-4 men around there that was maintenance men or whatever you wanted to say.
Do you recall what percentage of loss we'd have on these burnings? If we put 330,000 brick in there, could we expect to get 300,000 good brick out?
I would imagine so. That's probably close. There were several of them had to be hauled away. A lot of them were broken when they were handling and loading them. And of course, I think they sold them two ways, kill run and hand-picked. And hand-picked, they threw out all the broken ones.
I see. Now, let me ask you this. When they plastered up those kills, they used the rejects, so they didn't have to use the new bricks for the outside liner. Is that correct?
That's right. And then they sold a lot of those rejects. Lots of people bought those. We call them three-quarter brick.
Now then, after the era of the coal and the wood went by, did Father install a oil burning system with nozzles and jets in order to get more even burnings?
Yes, he did. Quite an investment that came too late. There were two 10,000 or 11,000 gallon tanks, plus many pumps and steam fittings and the burners and the piping. It was a real expensive deal, but It just came too late.
All right. Now, for the benefit of recording local history, do these names sound familiar to you, Wyman? William Schultz,
yeah.
Rudy Schultz, yeah. George Schultz.
Several of those men are still alive, or some of them, rather.
And Andrew Papps, was he one of our Wheelers?
Well, Andy worked for us. He's still alive, by the way. I think probably that he did a little bit of everything.
How about Emil Wittenberg? He's listed here as a dumper on the payroll records. Do you recall him?
Yes, I remember Emil. He tells me that he worked there when I was born.
And how old are you right now, to give a little picture of this?
I'm 61.
And so...
Emil must be way up in the 80s.
And then Herbert Diedrich, our present drain commissioner, I see he's listed here as a trucker. Is that correct?
Yeah, he worked the last year when I worked there. By the way, we forgot a couple of things. I worked a half a day, and Brother Joe worked the other half on the same job. And my oldest brother, John, drove the horse on the clay car those last years, so that it was... Dad kept most of us boys busy.
It was really a family operation.
That's right, and you were probably playing in the sand part of the time, or bringing us lunches or something.
Well, I'd like to remind you that Father assigned the younger members of the family to edge the lower rows of brick in the drying sheds, and we all pitched in. What about Otto Kurtzals, who died here recently, and Sid Tyler and Philip Jarvis?
Yes, Sid Tyler was an old name around there.